Welcome to Base by Base, the podcast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine for a moment the incredibly intricate network operating within your brain right now. I mean, we're talking about billions of neurons constantly engaged in this complex ballet of communication, sending signals back and forth across tiny gaps called synapses.
Mm-hmm. It's constant.
Yeah, and the ceaseless exchange is the very foundation of everything we think, everything we feel, every movement we make. But what happens, what really happens when a crucial player in this extraordinary neural orchestra is missing, or, you know, just isn't playing its part correctly?
Well, it breaks down.
Exactly. Today, we're embarking on an exploration of some really groundbreaking new research. It's identified a specific gene and the profound impact its deficiency has on the brain. We're talking about a newly defined neurodevelopmental disorder. It's characterized by some really challenging symptoms like severe developmental delay, significant intellectual disability, and in many cases, persistent, difficult-to-treat epilepsy. This isn't just about, you know, adding a new name to a list of conditions. It's about peeling back the deepest layers of brain function to understand the fundamental mechanics of communication and precisely what goes wrong when that communication falters.
Well, and on that note, today we should really celebrate the monumental work of a large international collaborative team. The corresponding authors are Ristor, Kirill A. Martemyanov, and Danielle Kopmans, along with, I mean, numerous colleagues.
It really took a village for this one.
Absolutely. Their extensive research spanned multiple institutions across the UK, US, Belgium, Switzerland, Iran. It really has significantly advanced our understanding of this newly defined neurodevelopmental disorder linked to the ELFN1 gene. It's a true testament to global scientific cooperation.
Definitely. So let's set the stage a bit, because the context here is, well, it's vital. We know that many neurodevelopmental disorders, especially the rare ones, seem to be rooted in problems with this crucial synaptic communication we just talked about.
Right, the connections between neurons.
Exactly. But for far too many of these conditions, the exact molecular cause, the why behind the symptoms, it just remains a frustrating mystery. And that's precisely where this investigation begins.
Indeed. I mean, synaptic transmission relies on this vast, exquisitely coordinated network of molecules. They allow neurons to make physical contact, release chemical messengers, neurotransmitters, and then, you know, receive those messages on the other side.
A very complex chain of events.
Very. And when any part of this intricate system is disrupted, it can lead to a wide spectrum of neuropsychiatric conditions. A key player in all this is glutamate. It's the brain's main excitatory neurotransmitter.
The go signal, essentially.
Pretty much, yeah. It revs up brain activity. And its actions are partly mediated by a specific group of receptors known as metabotropic G protein-coupled receptors, or mGlu receptors.
Okay, and this is where our spotlighted gene, ELFN1, enters the picture, right? What exactly is its job in this complex dance?
Precisely. ELFN1. And yeah, it stands for extracellular leucine-rich repeat and fibronectin type 3 domain-containing protein 1. Quite a mouthful.
Definitely mouthful.
Yeah. It's basically a critical architect at the synapse. It's a transmembrane protein.
Meaning it spans the cell membrane.
Right. It stretches across the cell's outer boundary. And its main job is to properly position certain mGlu receptors, particularly group 3 mGlu receptors, right where they need to be.
Okay.
Think of ELFN1 as an anchor. It helps localize and modulate the function of these crucial receptors. Now, previous research, mostly in mouse models, had already hinted it was important.
Right, I remember reading about that.
Yeah, like deleting the ELFN1 gene in mice leads to a loss of a specific receptor called synaptic mGlu7. And this impairs its function as a presynaptic autoreceptor.
Hold on, a presynaptic autoreceptor. What does that actually do for the neuron? How does that affect things?
Great question. It's basically like a feedback loop, almost like a brake pedal.
Okay.
On the neuron itself, the one sending the signal, it normally helps to, you know, dial down the release of those chemical signals.
Like glutamate.
Exactly, like glutamate. So if that brake is faulty because ELFN1 isn't doing its job, well, you get an excessive release of glutamate. Overstimulation.
Okay, that makes sense. Too much go signal.
Precisely. And this same mouse research also showed a loss of another receptor, mGlu6, but this time in the retina. And that completely abolished communication for rod photoreceptors. it severely impaired dim vision.
So night blindness, essentially.
Yes, night blindness.
And importantly, these mouse models didn't just show vision problems. They also had things like hyperactivity and seizures, which, I mean, that sounds alarmingly familiar to some human conditions. That connection must have been a huge clue.
Oh, it was a crucial piece of the puzzle. Absolutely. Prior human studies had indeed hinted at ELFN1's involvement, but, you know, the picture was fragmented. There was one family with a homozygous frameshift deletion, meaning both copies of the gene were severely disrupted, and they presented with epileptic encephalopathy and developmental issues.
Yeah.
In another family, they had a more subtle change, a missense variant, but they also showed intellectual disability and seizures.
So the link was there, but maybe not completely solid.
Exactly. The exact role of all the different ELFN01 variants and the full spectrum of symptoms, it was still largely uncertain. Just too few cases, and the outcomes varied quite a bit. So this new, really comprehensive research set out to definitively evaluate the role and the precise mechanism of these biallelic ELFN1 variants, meaning changes in both copies of the gene in causing disease. They wanted to connect all the dots.
That sounds like a monumental task. I mean, given how challenging it is to diagnose and understand these rare conditions, what was the research approach? How did this team finally bring that definitive clarity? How did they act like scientific detectives here?
Well, their approach was truly comprehensive. Really integrated. They combined clinical observations with very robust genetic and functional investigations. First, they dramatically expanded the patient group, the cohort.
Yeah.
They described 8 newly identified individuals from 5 unrelated families.
Wow, 8 new ones.
Yeah. All carrying homozygous ELFN1 variants, including severe frame shifts and even some in-frame deletions. Then, they meticulously integrated this new data with clinical details from 6 previously reported individuals. That brought the total to 14 patients from 7 unrelated families.
Oh, so a much bigger group.
Much bigger. And spanning diverse origins too, Iran, Mexico, Palestine, Turkey. This broad data set gave them a much, much richer clinical picture than ever before.
Right, a broader picture than just those few initial studies. What kind of clinical details did they gather to, you know, build this comprehensive picture?
Well, their local clinicians meticulously reported all the patient features. A clinical geneticist expertly described facial characteristics using standardized terminology, the HPO terms.
Okay.
And pediatric neuroradiologists and neurologists reviewed brain MRIs and EEG readings. They were looking for any brain abnormalities or specific patterns of electrical activity.
And the genetics.
On the genetic side, patient samples underwent extensive genome or exome sequencing. And they use sophisticated computational tools, SIFT, CADE, you know, the ones to predict the potential harmfulness of the variants they found. And critically, they checked variant frequencies against massive population databases like NOMAD-D.
To make sure they were actually rare, right?
Exactly. Rarity is a strong indicator of potential pathogenicity for these kinds of conditions.
That covers the clinical and genetic side of the investigation really well. But they also needed to understand how these variants, down at the molecular level, actually cause the problems. How do they dig into that?
Absolutely. And this is where their functional validation became so critical. They used human cell models, specifically HEK293T cells, a common lab workhorse,
right,
to understand how the mutated ELFN1 protein behaved at a cellular level. They essentially ran a kind of shipping and receiving check.
Okay, like what?
Well, using techniques like cell surface biotinylation and Western blotting, they could see if the ELFN1 protein actually reached the cell's outer membrane, which is essential for its function.
So did it get delivered to the right address?
Precisely. And then, using powerful confocal fluorescent microscopy, they could visually confirm exactly where the protein ended up inside the cell. Was it stuck somewhere, or did it make it out?
And what about understanding the structural impact? How do you figure out how just a tiny genetic change, maybe one amino acid, impacts the actual physical shape of a protein?
Yeah, that's tricky. For specific variants, like an in-frame single amino acid deletion they found, they used cutting-edge computational structural modeling. They used AlphaFold.
Oh, AlphaFold. Okay.
Yeah. This let them predict the protein's 3D structure and understand how that mutation might physically disrupt crucial domains, like key interaction sites. And furthermore, they did these things called protein G pulldowns. It's essentially a molecular fishing expedition.
Fishing?
Yeah. To directly test if the mutated ELFN1 could still grab onto or interact with its crucial partners, those group 3 ANGLU receptors we talked about, like MDGLU4, MDGLU7, and MDGLU8. That interaction is fundamental.
So they checked if it could still hold hands with its partners at the synapse.
That's a good way to put it, yes.
Okay, so bridging the gap from molecules in a dish to actual living systems, what did observing the animal models reveal? How did that connect these lab bench findings back to the symptoms seen in the patients? This is where it gets incredibly compelling.
Indeed. This is where you see if the molecular defect actually causes the kinds of problems seen in people. They used two key animal models. First, they examined ELFN1 homozygous knockout mice completely lacking the ELFN1 gene.
Okay, the knockout mice.
Right. Using a standard test called the open field test, they assessed locomotor activity, comparing these mice to their heterozygous littermates, those with one good copy, and wild-type littermates with two good copies.
And the second model.
Second, they used a zebrafish model. Zebrafish are great for this kind of work. They induced a loss of function by knocking down the zebrafish versions of ELFN1, the orthologs. Then they did detailed behavioral analysis, again looking at locomotor activity. But crucially, they also did non-invasive local field potential recordings.
So measuring brain waves, basically.
Exactly, in the fish.
Yeah.
These recordings allowed them to directly detect and quantify epileptiform brain activity, seizure-like activity, providing a powerful and direct link to the seizures seen in patients.
Wow. Okay, so with that incredibly rigorous, multifaceted methodology, clinical, genetic, cellular, structural, animal models, what did they actually uncover? Let's start with the overall clinical picture that emerged across this bigger group of patients.
Well, the clinical features across the 14 patients, who range in age from 10 months to 21 years, were undeniably striking and remarkably consistent in some ways. All patients, without exception, exhibited significant developmental delay. It profoundly impacted their motor skills and their speech acquisition.
Every single one.
Every single one. An intellectual disability was reported in all of them as well, ranging from moderate to severe. Mm. Though one patient seemed milder, but they were also very young, so it might be too early to tell the full extent.
Understood. And beyond those core developmental delays, what about other neurological symptoms or behaviors?
Yeah, many patients showed challenging behavioral disturbances. Things like traits consistent with ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, repetitive movements, stereotype errors. And even some self-injurious behaviors like biting and self-mutilation in a few cases. Neurological signs were also common. Low muscle tone or hypotonia was seen in 9 patients. General muscle weakness, issues with gait, how they walk.
What about facial features? Sometimes these syndromes have a characteristic look.
That's an interesting point. While certain features, like maybe a thick lower lip or a broad nasal tip, were frequently observed across the group, the expert evaluations didn't identify a single consistent facial gestalt.
So it's not a condition you diagnose just by looking at someone's face?
Exactly. That's an important detail. It points more towards the underlying brain function being the core issue.
Okay, so not one specific look, but definitely a shared and challenging pattern of developmental and neurological difficulties. Now, the epilepsy that seemed to emerge as a particularly defining and severe characteristic.
Yes, epilepsy was a truly critical finding. A striking 12 out of the 14 patients experienced seizures.
Wow, almost all of them.
Almost all. And notably, all the patients who had biallelic ELFN1 deletions, where both gene copies were missing or completely non-functional, all of them developed seizures.
That seems like a very strong correlation.
Extremely strong. The onset age varied quite a bit, though, from as early as 15 days old up to 8 years. So it wasn't predictable exactly when it would start. And the seizure types varied, too. Tonic, myoclonic, bilateral tonic-clonic seizures, infantile spasms in some.
What about the EEG? Did that show a specific pattern?
The EEG findings, which measure brain electrical activity, they definitely showed abnormal patterns. Things like globally slowed and dysregulated activity, very sharp waves, slow waves, but no single specific EEG pattern emerged that was unique just to these patients.
And how treatable were these seizures?
That's the really challenging part. The response to anti-seizure medications was highly variable. Many patients experienced refractory seizures.
Meaning hard to control with standard drugs.
Exactly. Difficult to control, highlighting the immense challenge in managing this aspect of the disorder.
What about structural changes in the brain itself? Did the MRIs show anything consistent?
Well, brain MRI studies were done on 6 patients. 2 of them did show some degree of volume loss and thinning of the corpus callosum. That's the bridge connecting the 2 brain hemispheres.
Okay.
One patient also had some cerebellar atrophy, which can affect coordination. Another had an issue with a joint near the skull and a cyst. But the findings were quite varied, and some MRIs were actually reported as normal.
So it's not like there's one big structural defect causing everything.
Precisely. It strongly suggests the problem is more at the functional, the molecular level, the way the synapses are working, rather than a large-scale structural issue.
Okay. So the clinical picture is clear. A spectrum of severe neurodevelopmental issues, with epilepsy being prominent and really tough to manage. What did the genetic investigation specifically lock down about the mutations causing this?
Yeah, the genetic detective work consistently pointed right at the ELFN1 gene. All 14 patients were found to have homozygous variants, identical changes inherited from both parents in ELFN1. 6 of the 7 families had biallelic deletions. Some of these led to the protein being cut off too early, basically non-functional. One even deleted the entire starting region, the 5-foot UTR, so the gene probably couldn't even be read to make protein at all.
Total loss of function there.
Pretty much. And that one previously described family had a biallelic missense variant, a more subtle single amino acid change. But crucially, none of these specific biallelic variants were found in those large population databases.
Meaning they're incredibly rare and likely disease-causing.
Exactly. Strongly suggesting their pathogenic role. And the computational predictions also overwhelmingly supported them being harmful. The genetic evidence was really definitive this time.
Okay, this raises the big question then. We know the gene is mutated, we see the clinical picture, but how do these specific genetic changes actually cause the disease? What's the fundamental molecular screw-up?
That's where those functional studies become absolutely critical.
Yeah.
And they found something really consistent. They found that all the identified ELFN1 variants, including that missense variant and the in-frame deletion, severely disrupted the protein's ability to traffic or travel to the cell surface.
Ah, so it's made, but it can't get to where it needs to work.
Exactly. This is huge. Even if the protein was expressed okay inside the cell, it simply couldn't reach its proper location on the plasma membrane to do its job anchoring those NBLU receptors.
So it's a loss of function because it's in the wrong place.
Precisely. It essentially means these variants lead to a complete loss of function for the ELFN1 protein at the synapse. And for that in-frame deletion, the AlphaFold modeling predicted it would mess up a specific domain.
Right.
And sure enough, their pull-down experiments showed that this variant also prevented ELFN1 from interacting with its crucial MGLU receptor partners.
So multiple lines of evidence pointing to the same problem. The protein isn't functional at the synapse where it's needed. It's like a vital piece of the brain's communication infrastructure is missing or just incorrectly installed.
That's a perfect analogy.
Okay, and what about the animal models? Did they confirm these fundamental defects and link them back to the complex symptoms like hyperactivity and seizures?
They did, quite powerfully. The mouse models of ELFN1 deficiency confirmed the hyperactivity link. Both the homozygous mice, no ELFN1, and even the heterozygous mice, one good copy, one bad, showed increased locomotor activity in that open field test.
Wait, even the heterozygous ones with only one bad copy?
Yes, which is significant because it suggests a potential haploinsufficiency, meaning maybe even having just one fully working copy of the gene isn't quite enough for optimal function.
Interesting. Hinting at maybe a broader spectrum of effects even with less severe mutations.
Potentially, yes. It warrants further investigation.
And the zebrafish. What do they tell us specifically about the seizures, which are such a challenging part of this condition?
The zebrafish models provided really strong direct evidence for that link to epilepsy. Knocking down either of the two zebrafish ELFN1 orthologs led to a significant jump in locomotor activity, indicative of hyperactivity and maybe seizure-like behavior.
Okay.
But even more compellingly, those non-invasive brain recordings. They showed a significant increase in spontaneous epileptiform events, actual seizure-like electrical bursts in the brain.
Wow, you could see it directly.
Directly, and altered patterns in the power spectral density, another measure of brain activity. It directly demonstrated epileptiform brain activity. These animal model results strongly correlate with those core clinical features of hyperactivity, and most notably, epilepsy seen in the patients. It really offers invaluable insight into the disease mechanism.
Okay, so bringing this all together now, what does this study mean for our overall understanding of neurodevelopmental disorders? How does it fundamentally change the landscape, or at least clarify a part of it?
Well, I think this study provides enough robust evidence from all those different angles to definitively establish ELFN1 deficiency as a distinct neurodevelopmental disorder. They propose naming it ELFN1-related deficiency disorder. And it's now clearly defined as a rare autosomal recessive Mendelian's disorder with a specific recognizable clinical spectrum.
Having that clear definition is so important for diagnosis.
Crucial for diagnosis, for prognosis and for future research directions.
And the seizures really do stand out as a defining characteristic, don't they? Especially that link with the biallelic deletions.
Yes, absolutely. Seizures appear to be the key defining finding. They seem almost invariably present in patients with those biallelic deletions, although, as we said, the onset and type can vary. And what's particularly powerful is how the animal model data, especially that spontaneous epileptiform activity in the zebrafish.
Right, seeing the brain activity itself.
It just so precisely reinforces this correlation between ELFN1 deficiency and the epileptic phenotypes. Now, managing these seizures, as we noted, remains a huge clinical challenge because they're often refractory. But having this clear genetic link provides a direct target. We know what's broken, which is the first step towards fixing it.
Right. What about the other symptoms, like the developmental delay or the behavioral issues? Are they as universally consistent?
The neurodevelopmental delay was consistent across all patients, so that really highlights a core aspect of the disorder. The neuropsychiatric diagnoses, like autism spectrum disorder traits or ADHD, those were more variable across the cohort.
Okay.
But that increased locomotion seen in both the mouse and the zebrafish models certainly reminds us of the hyperactivity seen in some patients. It connects the animal findings nicely to the human experience. And it's also worth remembering that some ELFN1 variants, maybe less severe ones, have been identified in other studies looking at patients with autistic features or ADHD for the connecting those dots. It suggests ELFN1 plays a role in broader neural network function.
Were there any unexpected findings, or perhaps areas for future exploration that this study really opened up, things we still don't know?
Well, one interesting thing was joint laxity. Some previous reports had mentioned it, but this larger study didn't consistently observe it in their expanded patient group, nor did they see it in the animal models. So that might not be a core consistent feature after all.
Okay.
But a really important and perhaps hidden area for future investigation is dim vision function. Or night blindness.
Ah, yes, from the mouse retina findings.
Exactly. The mouse models strongly predict this should be an issue in patients because ELFN1 has such an established role in rod photoreceptor signaling in the retina. Yet none of the patients in this particular study underwent electroretinogram testing, ERG testing, which is the specific test needed to check retinal function in detail.
So it could be a significant symptom that just hasn't been looked for systematically.
It absolutely could be. A hidden symptom that future research could reveal and potentially address. Something clinicians should maybe be aware of now.
Definitely. So this deep dive provides a really solid foundation for understanding ELFN1 deficiency. What are the broader implications of achieving this kind of clarity, particularly for developing, say, precision medicine approaches?
Well, by definitively defining this disorder and crucially, clarifying that loss of function mechanism, the idea that the ELFN1 protein isn't getting where it needs to be.
The trafficking defect.
This research opens critical doors for future investigations into the precise pathophysiology. How exactly does this lead to seizures and developmental delay? And knowing this specific synaptic dysfunction suggests potential therapeutic avenues. Could we develop therapies aimed at restoring the protein's function? Maybe gene therapy. Or perhaps chaperone drugs that could help the mutated protein traffic correctly.
Oh, interesting.
Or maybe therapies targeting synaptic modulation more broadly, or enhancing neuroplasticity. These could offer promising new treatment options down the line. This level of precision, you know, pinpointing the exact molecular defect, is such a critical step towards true precision medicine for these complex, challenging neurodevelopmental conditions.
Yeah, it really transforms understanding from just a collection of symptoms into a specific, potentially targetable mechanism.
Exactly.
So to sum up this whole exploration, what's the core insight for you, our listeners, to take away?
I'd say it's that ELFN1 deficiency is now clearly established as a distinct neurodevelopmental disorder. It's caused by loss of function variants in the ELFN1 gene, and these variants disrupt crucial synaptic communication. This disruption leads to a complex spectrum of symptoms, most notably varying degrees of intellectual disability, significant developmental delay, and often severe refractory epilepsy, frequently alongside hyperactivity.
And a final thought for you, the listener, to consider. What does this really mean for how we approach understanding and treating neurodevelopmental disorders more broadly? How might a deeper understanding of specific synaptic proteins, like ELF1, pave the way for truly targeted treatments, especially for those grappling with such challenging epileptic components? Can we move beyond just managing symptoms towards actually addressing the root biological cause? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.